This is the RTE News at 1 with Brian Dobson. Good afternoon. The headlines this Wednesday lunchtime. Sinn Féin has criticised the government for the cancellation of more than 250,000 hospital appointments last year. More details have emerged about the deal designed to pave the way for the reopening of Tara Mines. And the Minister for Education, Norma Foley, has announced a reduction in grade inflation for exam students next year. The news in detail with Brian Jennings.
A quarter of a million hospital appointments were cancelled last year, and this included 800 chemotherapy appointments for children, the Doyle has heard. The Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, said the cancellation of children's chemotherapy must be unimaginable for worried parents. The Taoiseach Simon Harris said improvements in the health service had been made and he was intent that they would continue to be made. Our political correspondent, Micheál Lehan.
Mary Lou MacDonald told The Dáil there was a shortage of hospital beds and there needs to be more doctors employed too. She called for 3,000 new hospital and community beds, along with the lifting of the recruitment embargo. The Taoiseach said waiting times are improving in the health service, but he conceded there is a hell of a long way to go. Since the last general election, there are 28,000 more people working in the health service, and 2,200 additional staff can be hired this year, Simon Harris said. To any parent of a sick child, the Taoiseach said he wanted them to know that government would continue to invest more resources in the health service.
Around 160 jobs are expected to be lost at Tara Mines as part of an agreement to reopen the facility. The redundancies will be on a voluntary basis. An agreement to reopen the mine was reached overnight following talks between unions and management at the Workplace Relations Commission. Our work and technology correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
Around 50 workers are thought to have retired or taken early retirement since Tara Mines was temporarily closed and placed into care and maintenance 9 months ago. As part of this deal to reopen the mine, there will be around 160 voluntary redundancies. Core pay for remaining staff will be protected, but there are expected to be changes to work practices. In a letter to staff circulated in the early hours of this morning, management at Boleyn Tara Mines said that if the agreement is accepted by workers, it would immediately begin the process of reopening the mine, but that it would take some time for the operation to resume in full. Under the new agreement, the terms of a proposed voluntary severance scheme will be enhanced for those who wish to avail of it. Tara Mines closed temporarily in July last year, resulting in the laying off of 650 workers.
The Minister for Education, Norma Foley, has announced a reduction in grade inflation for exam students next year. The practice to apply increases to grades began during the COVID years to compensate students for the disruption they faced because of restrictions that were imposed. Teaching unions have said every effort must be made to ensure fairness and equity for students. Kate Carlin reports.
A phased return to a normal Leaving Cert system will begin next year, with grade inflation reducing from 7.5% to around 5.5%, possibly lower. The Education Minister, Norma Foley, stressed that these changes will not affect students sitting their state exams this year. However, in the interest of fairness, a gradual return to normality must get underway in 2025, she said. The Minister said a number of accommodations introduced as a result of COVID will remain in place. These include greater choice on exam papers, while the Irish Oral will continue to account for only 10% of the exam. Minister Foley also confirmed that the Leaving Cert results will be issued on Friday, the 23rd of August.
The United States has said it hopes that economic sanctions against Iran will help persuade Israel to limit its response to hundreds of Iranian missiles being fired at its territory at the weekend. Iran said it took the action because it believes Israel bombed its consulate in Syria that killed several senior Iranian military commanders. Israel has not commented on the Syrian explosion. The British Foreign Secretary David Cameron, who's in Jerusalem, said Israel had clearly decided to retaliate against Iran. Professor Giles Keppel, a former Middle East envoy for France, said he believed Israel would strike one of the powerful groups which Iran supports.
My belief is that retaliation will mainly be aimed at Hezbollah in Lebanon, not directly at Iran, because this would, you know, definitely mean significant escalation. The only member of the axis of resistance, you know, led by Tehran, that remains with a significant capacity is Hezbollah. This strike would be probably more efficient from an Israeli military point of view than an attack on Iran.
Now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Grant. Create a modern minimalistic home decor look and warmth in every room with Grant Uflex underfloor heating. Visit grant.ie.
This afternoon there'll be patchy rain and drizzle that'll be persistent for a time in the north and northeast. There will be clearer weather later. Highest temperatures will range from 8 to 12 degrees. Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Still to come this lunchtime, a plan to reopen Tara Mines, but with a reduced workforce and new employment terms. We'll hear from the trade union SIPDU on a deal to get hundreds of its members back to work. House and department prices rising at their fastest in a year, with the biggest increases in the Midwest, an Ennis state agent's experience. Protecting vulnerable adults, safeguarding Ireland on those recommendations from the Law Reform Commission. It's getting worse, the experience of one on post TV license inspector after the RT scandals, and Dubai downpour, flash floods in the Desert Kingdom.
Looking for great value car and home insurance? Say hello to OutSurance and our unique Out bonus that gives you 10% of your insurance premiums back in cash when you hold your policy claim free for 3 years. You always pay in, so why shouldn't you get something out? For a competitive quote, call OutSurance on 1800 600 400 or visit outsurance.ie. Out bonus calculated less taxes and levies. Exceptions, criteria, terms and conditions apply. Car and home insurance is underwritten by OutSurance DAC. OutSurance DAC trading as OutSurance is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Hi, Ian Dempsey here. Special Olympics Ireland needs your help. I've seen the joy, opportunity and community that Special Olympics provides for athletes with an intellectual disability. But we need your support to make this happen. Head to specialolympics.ie or donate on Revolut. Let's show them our support and make their dreams a reality.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. As we've been hearing, around 160 jobs are expected to go at Tara Mines in County Meath as part of a deal to resume operations. Tara, the largest lead and zinc mine in Europe, closed 9 months ago with the layoff of 650 staff. The owners, Boliden, blamed a fall in commodity prices and rising costs. Now a deal to reopen the facility has been agreed at the Workplace Relations Commission. We've been hearing more from Union Representative Adrian Kane, SIPTU Division Organiser for Tara Mines.
The WRC brokered proposals in the early hours of the morning between the unions and management. And in broad stroke, and both sides have agreed to recommend those proposals for implementation. So we will be meeting with our members to go through the detail of those proposals. But just in broad stroke, Brian, probably the most important piece of this is the commitment to reopen the mine from June of this year on a phased basis and a return to work over a 6 to 7 month period. There had been a question mark over the future of the mine. What we have tried to secure through these negotiations is for the mine to reopen and to stay open. What we've also secured is that people return to work on their core terms and conditions of employment. Now, unfortunately, there are going to be redundancies, but they will be on a voluntary basis. But it has been a very, very difficult time for our members over the last 9 months. And this is the first bit of good news in terms of a commitment to reopen the mine that they've had over that period of time.
So there's about 600 of a workforce, and the company's looking for, is it about 160 voluntary redundancies?
That's probably around the number at this stage. Some people would have gone on early retirement and just normal retirement as well over the last number of months. So we would envisage the level of redundancies would be somewhere around the 160 mark.
And so for those who would choose to return, they would return on their previous pay, but not necessarily working conditions. There will be new work practices, is that right?
The company have tried and looked for significant changes in work practices. And rather than getting into those details, that's something that we have to engage with our members and to go through that with them. But yes, I think it would be fair to say that they have looked for, and the proposals contain significant changes in work practices. But I think it's also very important to emphasise that we have achieved the maintenance of core terms and conditions. It's the work practices is the area that will be changing.
And if this agreement, if this proposal is accepted, what's the timescale for getting the mine fully up and running again?
Probably somewhere in the region of 6 to 7 months from whence people would start to go back, which will be during the month of June.
So would there be a phased return to work then?
Yeah, it's not a simple thing getting a mine back up and running. And the last time that this happened, it took between 6 and 7 months, and it's a similar type time frame on this occasion also.
It's 9 months since the mine closed at the time temporarily. We were told, are all of those who were laid off at that stage ready and available to go back to work before people found work elsewhere?
I'd say probably most people have found some alternative employment, and that's that particular issue is dealt with in the proposals as well, in terms of how available people are and commitments to other employments also. I think it's also important just to say, with regard to this whole debacle, I suppose, over the last 6 or 7 months, what we did manage to achieve as well, and what one good thing to come out of it, was a reform around job seekers' benefit, which was never pay-related, but now government has given a commitment down to the work of the trade unions, and particularly the workers in Tara Mines, who lobbied very hard over the last number of months for a change in our social protection legislation. And that's going to come in December. They're not going to benefit from it, but it will mean other workers will benefit from it from when they're laid off, that they get a percentage of their average income, which is something that we didn't have when we were completely out of step with Europe. You know, that's one bright sort of aspect of the whole situation over the last 6 or 7 months, which has been really, really difficult for people, and also difficult for the entire region of the Northeast, which depends a lot on that mine. But as I say, first and foremost, from the proposals coming from the WRC, a commitment to open the mine, and that's really important.
And that's Adrian Kane, divisional organiser with SIP2. Residential property prices rose by 6.1% in the 12 months to February, the steepest increase in more than a year. The figures from the Central Statistics Office show prices in Dublin grew by 5.6%, while prices outside the capital were up 6.5%. In the Midwest, counties of Clare, Tipperary and Limerick, prices increased by almost 11%. David Costello of Costello Estate Agents in Ennis has been explaining what he sees in Clare.
From our experience on the ground, it's not surprising, being honest with you. It's driven, I suppose, by a number of factors. The first is, on the second-hand market, is a complete lack of stock, lack of trade. A lot of that would stem from the COVID times, when a lot of properties were taken off the market, and therefore the overall supply stock fell and has never been replenished. I suppose the second thing is, new homes have gone up a lot in price, probably twofold, for two reasons. The first being obviously the inflationary costs coming out of the Ukrainian war, which is added to the value of creating the product. And the second thing is that the majority of new homes, particularly in a town like Ennis or even the likes of Limerick City or whatever, over the last 3 to 4 years, have been bought by the state, either by way of the local authority or one of the housing bodies.
David Costello, an estate agent in Ennis. Well, let's talk now to Trevor Grant, who's chair of the Association of Irish Mortgage Advisors and is on the line. Trevor, thanks for taking our call this lunchtime. People could be forgiven for thinking that house prices, home and apartment prices here are defying the laws of gravity, continuing to rise very significantly against a backdrop of increases in interest rates, the cost for mortgage going up, and very strict rules, lending rules being enforced by the central bank. What's going on?
Good afternoon, Brian. You could be forgiven for thinking that. I think fundamentally the issue here, and it's a well-known story, is that there's a significant lack of supply of property, be it second-hand and new. We did see exceptional growth in housing commencements in quarter one of this year, but quarter one won't solve the problem. We simply have a significant lack of property. The economy has stood up fairly well, so we did see a period last year where house price inflation began to fall, and it cooled to a low last August. That was on the back of interest rates increasing on a fairly consistent basis, and there'd been a lot of uncertainty. But we're now in a period where rates seem to have flattened out. There's a lot of talk about ECB most likely cutting interest rates. The economy has been resilient, so the demand and approvals being sought by first-time buyers is very significant. But not only do we have a problem of not enough new homes, as David said earlier in your piece, we also have the state competing with private purchasers to buy property, and that's what's driving up prices.
So, and we've seen this from previous surveys and previous statistics, although 30,000 plus houses are being completed now this year and into next, and that number may continue to rise, relatively few of those are finding their way onto the open market.
Yes, in reality, you're probably finding about a third of those being available to the open market, which simply doesn't cater for demand that's there. And that's what's really hurting the prices.
But also the other side of the equation, Trevor, there are buyers who have the money, who have the deposit, who've managed to put the funds aside and can afford these higher interest rates that certainly are continuing to pertain.
There are indeed, and that was my point about the economy has been fairly solid. A lot of people have been renting. We have a rental situation where there isn't enough accommodation for people wishing to rent. So for a lot of people, the option to buy, even with increased rates, is relatively cheaper to the uncertainty and the difficulty in finding a rental property. So you are finding people are being approved. The central bank rules are there. They're being obeyed. We aren't having people approved as they were in the Celtic Tiger years. There's a lot of work that goes into preparing someone to get mortgage approved and for them to be able to prove they can afford the mortgage. So this is going to be, unfortunately, an ongoing problem, Brian.
Why do you think we're seeing some big divergences in terms of the regional picture, that double-digit increase in the Midwest, almost twice the rate of increase seen, for example, in Dublin?
It's interesting, and the Midwest led the way in the March figures as well, if I'm not mistaken. I think what you're looking at there is you've got the population base, there's a very solid infrastructure, and there's a demand for services. So increasingly, you have a lot of people who are working in good jobs, earning good money, who want to settle in the Midwest. You might even have a portion of people who may have been historically working in Dublin, can't afford to buy in Dublin, or maybe moving home or moving to relatives or to job opportunities. So that's what you're starting to see now. The price issue initially was Dublin. You're now seeing it filtered throughout the country simply because people are desperately trying to find a home.
Trevor Grant from the Association of Irish Mortgage Advisors, thanks very much for that. The jury at the Stardust fire inquest has said it still needs time to consider its verdicts. The coroner has said that she'll speak to them again this afternoon. Let's talk to our reporter, Conor Hunt, who's been attending the inquest for us. So what's the latest? We were hearing yesterday, Conor, from the inquest jury that they were very close to completing their verdicts. What are they saying today?
Well, things started a little differently today. The jury began their deliberations at 10 a.m, an hour earlier than normal. And as you say, that follows the comments from the foreman yesterday, you'll recall, when he said that they were very close to reaching verdicts. So just after 11 a.m, the jury filed into the courtroom and the coroner briefly addressed them. She asked if they were satisfied with the answers they got yesterday to questions they had asked. They said they were. Now, those questions centered around the factors that must be met to reach certain verdicts. The foreman then said that the jury still had some issues that needed to be ironed out, and so said that the time was still needed, he said. Now, the coroner then accepted that and said she'd speak with them again this afternoon. And with that, the members returned to the jury room. The court has previously heard how the jury has been given a questionnaire to be filled out dealing with each individual victim and another set of questions dealing with the circumstances around the fire. And as we've said here many times before, these inquests have gone on for a year, over 300 witness statements. So a lot for them to consider. They've five verdicts open to them, and has been the case throughout. There are a number of families in the gallery today. A lot more media present too here as well. So it does seem or appear that we're edging closer to a conclusion, but we just have to wait and see.
And just briefly, if you can, Conor, how this might be handled when the jury's ready to deliver its verdicts. Will there then be an opportunity, some time given for the families to gather before the verdicts are actually delivered?
Yeah, well, that hasn't been discussed in open court, but there is a suggestion that there will be notice given to some of the families so they can be here in greater numbers at the pillar room on the grounds of the Rotunda. Remember, obviously, this was very much a Dublin disaster. Lots of the victims came from the north side of Dublin, but those families have scattered around the place since. We have some families coming in from Spain, I believe, the north as well, and from other parts of Ireland as well. So we understand that there will be some notice given, but we haven't got confirmation of that yet.
Very good. Conor Hunt at the Stardust Inquest, thanks very much for that. A new independent authority to protect vulnerable adults needs to be established, according to Safeguarding Ireland, which lobbies on behalf of older people and people with a disability. The charity was commenting on the Law Reform Commission report published today for a regulatory framework for adult safeguarding. The Commission is recommending new laws to criminalise those who abuse and exploit vulnerable people. Let's talk now to the Chair of Safeguarding Ireland, Patricia Rickard-Clark. A very good afternoon to you and welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ryan.
Can I ask you, first of all, who are we talking about here, vulnerable adults? What does that group, that cohort, include?
A large group, so many people with, say, capacity issues, decision-making capacity issues that come within the recent legislation of the Assisted Decision-Making Capacity Act, people with physical disability, also people who actually have difficulties or may be at risk and in vulnerable circumstances in life events, may have a bereavement, may be ill, may lose their job, may become bankrupt, all of those leaves them in very vulnerable situations and circumstances. And we have no, we spent a long time in, before we enacted child safeguarding legislation, we have no adult safeguarding legislation. So even people coming out of child services fall into a black hole. So we've no body with overall arching responsibility to take reports of safeguarding or actually oversight in terms of the various bodies, limited bodies that are involved at the moment. And in 2017, for example, Safeguarding Ireland was instrumental in tabling an adult safeguarding bill. And at that time, a joint Oireachtas committee said this was an urgent matter. And the current Taoiseach, who was then Minister for Health, actually referred this matter to the Law Reform Commission for consideration. So this is where we're at the moment. So the Commission has published this report.
And what kind of abuses are they vulnerable to?
All types of abuse. And I suppose people don't realise that coercive control is a very insidious type of abuse, where people take control over people. And in fact, coercive control permeates all types of abuse, be it physical abuse, sexual abuse, financial abuse, making decisions on behalf of people who are maybe capacity issues, older people, people with intellectual disability, all of those issues. So coercive control, as I say, permeates all types of abuse. We have coercive control provisions in the Domestic Violence Act, but that is limited to people who are in intimate, have been or are in intimate relationship. It doesn't include many older people. And even last week we heard Mary Carlin in the Irish Times reporting on adult parents taking actions against adult children who are abusing them physically, coming in, demanding their house, and etc. So they are all the issues, and we've no structure at the moment to deal with that.
So a key recommendation here, and I think it's one that you strongly support, is a national safeguarding authority. Now, what would it do under these recommendations, and what changes in the law would be necessary to give it teeth?
Well, we need, obviously, it to be an independent statutory body that would actually direct standards, make provisions and policies, and ensure that organisations and relevant bodies who are dealing with people in vulnerable circumstances or at-risk adults have proper safeguarding statements and plans in place. At the moment, we've no legislation or statutory facility to assess a person's needs, to assess their risk, or actually to provide a service to them when they're in need. So unless a person is, and again, there's a lot of emphasis on the health and social care service, but there are lots of people in the community living in very difficult circumstances that need help. And who do they report to? Again, the HSE has their safeguarding and protection teams, but they are limited to dealing with HSE services like disability services, older people services. It's not widespread. So there are huge gaps at the moment that need to be addressed in. But we, the Commission, has set out maybe some of the existing regulatory bodies, maybe a safeguarding body, or has the idea of an independent statutory body. Safeguarding Ireland is very anxious and actually would say that we need that independent body. For example, if you take the Brandon case and other cases by the HSE, they shouldn't be investigating their own services. We need that independence. We need independent reporting, and we need people to be signposted to appropriate services.
And just finally, the Law Reform Commission report includes, I think, am I correct in saying, two draft bills in this area? So
Is
this something that could be moved on fairly quickly, maybe even before the next election?
Absolutely. There are certain issues in that. For example, there is a Data Protection Act of 2018, which provides regulation for the sharing of data in circumstances. Mm-hmm. The Minister can do those regulations tomorrow and have them in place. One of the big issues is organisations work in silos and they don't share information that is vital maybe to protect an adult at risk. There are other issues like the coercive control. Again, that there was in the Senate that was debated last July when the Criminal Justice Miscellaneous Bill was going through, and we need that. So there are things like that that can be done immediately.
Very good. Patricia Rickard-Clark from Safeguarding Ireland, thank you very much for that. OnPost has confirmed TV licence inspectors underwent what it calls resilience training, initiated because staff faced increased hostility and aggression in the aftermath of the RTE controversy. They also said inspectors were confined to what they described as non-contact visits due to the level of aggression and abuse they were facing. Full inspections have now resumed. The annual conference of the Communications Workers Union has today heard that many homeowners remain unhappy and resistant to the licence fee. We've been speaking to Bill O'Sullivan, a TV licence inspector based in County Kerry.
Yeah, it has changed quite a bit from, I've had it 20 plus years now in the Kerry area. It's much more difficult overall. The public attitude and people are very resistant to, you know, buying the licence. There was based on the RTE scandal there, but that's kind of what they were making reference to. And as time has gone on there, they become more hardened and basically protesting. So it's made the job much more difficult. And there's uncertainty as well now, because there's been commentary there about as to what the funding model and all that is. So it's moved on to that. So people just are very resistant and unhappy.
And tell me, Bill, do people understand that you're just doing their job, or do they take it out on you personally?
They would understand, but they would also take it out personally. It's a bit of both, but much more so personally. You know, basically coming around here, asking for money, and how can I justify that? And they're very unhappy with that, and they comment on it, and they make it very clear. So initially, they do go on the front foot and are unhappy that I would show off and be looking for money and just asking me to justify why I'm there, and I do point that out, and some of them take it on board, more don't. So yes, it does, it gets more personal and unhappiness. Yeah.
I mean, it's a good 10 months since this controversy blew up. Has the situation improved at all, or is it as bad or even worse than it was at the outset?
I think overall it's worse. They're more resistant and unhappy with the whole situation, and they voice it much more so in recent weeks. I know they just keep commenting on that, and why should they be paying it when they made up some recently there, as of yesterday, a few days ago, somebody said, why should I pay it, and my money has gone down, you know, my money is gone, and that that there may be no license in the future, and why should they pay it? And they don't want to do so, and they're unhappy.
This report that unpussed, because of what people like yourself were facing, were offering resilience training. Is that something that you took up?
I haven't been able to avail of it as of yet myself personally. I do believe others have. I think that anything is helpful, but the public mood is the public mood. All training is helpful. It still doesn't alter the mood amongst people there, and their unhappiness and anger.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, you've been at the job for 20 years plus. Will you stick with it for as long as this model is in place, or are you thinking maybe it's time to move on?
Because of the reaction I'm getting, and because of the difficulty in dealing with people, and that, yes, I do question what the future holds, and I suppose, given the way it is, and the uncertainty again, I suppose, there as to whether there will be a job or not. There's over 100 inspectors up and down the country there, and some in terms of the funding, something needs to be put in place to secure the jobs. So I hope I will have a job as time goes on. It's the only thing, you know.
TV licence inspector Bill O'Sullivan. A clean-up is underway in the United Arab Emirates after torrential downpours killed at least one person and caused damage to homes and businesses. The UAE witnessed record rainfall with more than 250 millimetres falling in some parts yesterday in less than 24 hours, according to the National Meteorological Centre. Irishwoman Amanda Gavin has been living in Dubai for 11 years. She told the News at One that despite weather warnings from the government, the volume of rain took many by surprise.
It was catastrophic, really. Torrential rain, 4 or 5 bouts of it during the day, which has caused quite a lot of upset for families and businesses in the area. At 3 o'clock yesterday, literally the whole city went black, and it was like something I've never seen before, and then it was just torrential rain. Obviously the infrastructure, you know, with obviously Dubai being in sand, you know, it's not the best situation. So there was a lot of flooding. We have flooding in our villa. The whole top floor flooded because of the drains got blocked. So it was a kinder case of trying to keep the water at bay from destroying the whole house. But we managed to get it sorted and get it under control late last night when the rain stopped. So it's a lot of damage to a lot of properties, including our own.
Amanda Gavin. Well, let's talk now to Dubai-based journalist Casey Fitzgerald, who's on the line. Casey, thanks indeed for taking our call today. Now, there were warnings of this storm, but it seems they didn't capture the extent of the downpour.
Yeah, we had warnings a day in advance. Thanks for having me on, first of all, Brian, and thanks for covering the story. Government announced that schools would shut, so they had warnings ahead of time. Government offices closed, and a lot of people work from home on the day itself, thankfully, but still no one expected what we saw yesterday. As you said yourself, the biggest rainfall in the country's climatic history, 250 millimetres of rain in 24 hours, and just pitch black, intense storm, unlike I've ever seen before. It came in bouts throughout the day and just kind of lashed homes, and has resulted in kind of the major disruption of activity that we're seeing today.
And in your own case, Casey, I think you did make it to your workplace, but then had to return home.
Yeah, I work for a local news channel, Love in Dubai. We have a morning show, so I tried to make it in this morning, and so I got a bit of a glimpse of the aftermath on the roads. Some of the streets are still completely flooded, cordoned off, and when I eventually made it to the office, the doors were electronic and the building electricity was down, so the building itself was inaccessible. The home where I live, the lifts are broken, they're not working either. So it's affecting everyone on every level. There's no one that kind of was saved from this. Everyone has their own flood story after yesterday.
And at this stage, what's the assessment in terms of the damage? How big a cleanup operation is underway or is going to have to be undertaken?
We still don't have an idea of the scale. What we do know is schools have shut for the rest of the week, so that's good news for teachers and students. The airlines have suspended flights until midnight, which is kind of unheard of. You know, we've got one of the busiest, we have the world's busiest international airport. So for that to happen, it just kind of shows the scale of the disruption, because people are, you know, struggling to get to work at the airports. The roads around the airports are flooded. It's going to take more than a day or two to get back up and running, that's for sure. People's homes, businesses, the streets, But we do trust in the system here, you know. You can see the crisis management. I saw it this morning on the roads. It's already in operation. They're, you know, the trucks are out pumping the water from the streets. But it's just going to take longer. You know, we've had floods like this on the streets before, so we're used to this kind of operation. They have systems in place, but we've just never experienced this amount of rainfall.
All right. Casey, thanks indeed for talking to us. That's Casey Fitzgerald speaking to us there from Dubai. Back with more after this short break.
No chopping, no peeling, no mashing, no dishwashing, no bother. Centra's selected range of freshly prepared meals are now only 2 for €8. Mix and match tasty curries, rich lasagnas and more classics. Made by our experts to make dinner easy. Shop smart, feel good at Centra. Offer available until May 1st.
RTE Radio 1.
Paolo Nutini. Roman Park, Limerick, on Saturday the 13th of July. His only Irish show in 2024. With very special guest, C-Mat. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster.ie. Subject to licence. Paolo Nutini. Live at Roman Park. Tickets available now.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. A quarter of a million hospital appointments were cancelled last year, and this includes 800 chemotherapy appointments for children, the Doyle has been told. Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald said the cancellation of children's chemotherapy must be unimaginably worrying for parents. She told the Doyle that there was a lack of beds in hospitals and there need to be more doctors too.
We need to change of direction. Taoiseach Fine Gael have been in government for 13 years, for far too long. And more of the same won't cut it. Our health service is crying out for change. So to ensure that no child's chemotherapy appointment is cancelled due to crisis in the system, government has to increase bed capacity. We need 3,000 additional hospital and community beds. And well, you know it. And then, crucially, we need to end the recruitment embargo imposed by your government to relieve pressure on hospitals and to ensure that sick and sometimes very sick people get the care that they need.
In response, Taoiseach Simon Harris said waiting times are improving in the health service, but admitted there's a long way to go.
So I accept wait times in Ireland are too high, but I also have to say, as a point of fact, wait times are improving. More and more people are now getting seen within the Sláinte Care targets, which all parties in this Dáil, including your own, have signed up to. Bed capacity is growing, staff numbers are growing, the health budget is growing and will continue to. And to any parent of a sick child, and most particularly to a parent of a sick child with cancer, I want them to know that. I want them to know that we will continue to invest more in the services to make sure that their child has the best outcome. I want them to know that they live in a country that has really good outcomes when it comes to cancer care.
The Taoiseach speaking in the Dáil this lunchtime. A report by Amnesty International has found that thousands of people are being detained arbitrarily at camps in northeast Syria since the end of the ground war against Islamic State more than 5 years ago. Amnesty says the camps are now housing 56,000 detainees, which includes 30,000 children and 14,500 women. We've been speaking to the report's author, Lauren Ahrens, senior advisor on gender, conflict and international justice with Amnesty.
We're talking about Syrians, Iraqis and people from an estimated 74 other countries globally. And they've been detained in these detention facilities and camps since the fall of the Islamic State in 2019. Basically, after the last battles with Islamic State, people were kind of corralled into this system of detention by the authorities in northeast Syria with the support of the US-led coalition. We're talking 2 detention camps, Al-Hol and Raj, and 27 other detention facilities, many of them makeshift prisons.
And we'll talk about the conditions in a moment, but are these individuals who in some way were associated with ISIS?
It's a huge mix, which is one of the things we've sought to document in our report. So on the one hand, we believe, you know, it's very likely that there's some of the worst perpetrators of ISIS crimes held in this detention system. And our concern here is that they're not actually being brought to trial and therefore giving justice to ISIS victims. So yes, we think some of them are very much connected or likely to be very much connected to sort of command structure of ISIS and responsible for some, you know, of the worst crimes under international law we've seen in our generation. But actually, the majority of people in the detention system, in the camps and prisons, are children. 30,000 of the more than 56,000, 30,000 are children. It's actually the highest concentration of children detained anywhere in the world. And then in addition to that, what we found is that large numbers of people who are detained in this system are victims of trafficking. We documented that a large number of the women and children in particular were subjected to forced marriages by ISIS, or in the case of boys, child recruitment, and the trafficking victims haven't been identified as such.
And large numbers are foreign nationals, and do they have any prospect of repatriation?
There are very small levels of repatriation that are ongoing. Our concern is, I mean, we've been calling on states to do more in that regard, in particular in relation to children, people who were detained in the system as children, trafficking survivors, because states have obligations under international human rights law to repatriate trafficking survivors. So, you know, we very much feel that states should be doing more here, but we also recognize this isn't going to be the full solution. You know, we need a comprehensive we need some solutions. We need people to be charged or tried, including in northeast Syria, because large numbers of these people will never be able to return home. Mm-hmm. The majority are either Syrian from different parts of Syria, mostly under the control of the government, and it's not safe for them to return. Large numbers are also from Iraq, and for them, many of them, it won't be safe to return home or other countries where, if they're returned, they face serious human rights abuses like torture.
And meanwhile, Lauren, what kind of conditions are they being held in?
The conditions are horrific. I mean, they're really horrific. It depends a little bit on the facility in which someone's held. Or let's say they're all horrific, but the abuse, the violations we documented differ somewhat depending on the system. So for men and some of the boys, they're mostly in these detention facilities where we documented high levels of torture and really inhumane conditions that lead to deaths, at least some of these detention facilities. In one of them, we documented that hundreds of people have died in recent years, either as a result of physical abuse on the one side and then denial of food and medical treatment and even, you know, fresh air on the other, that's led to these deaths. So, I mean, so in the detention facilities, you know, all these terrible conditions. And then in the detention camps where most of the women and children are held, we're also documenting, you know, horrific conditions. And maybe just to pull out some of those, you know, we've documented high levels of gender-based violence that are going unchecked. And a real concern is the way women and their sons in particular are being forcibly separated from each other. Foreign national boys who reach the age of 11 or 12 are taken systematically from the camps, from their mothers, and taken away from them to these so-called rehabilitation centres, which are basically prisons. Mm. And that starts what seems to be an indefinite separation of foreign national women and their sons, which is, obviously a huge concern.
Sport on RTE Radio 1.
Good afternoon to Michael Corcoran. Michael.
Brian, thanks very much. Gavin Bozzino is a major doubt for Southampton's Premier League promotion push after picking up an injury ahead of his side's league game against Preston North End last night. The Republic of Ireland goalkeeper was injured in the warm-up, but Alex McCarthy brought in for his first league start. Bozzino appears to have damaged his Achilles tendon in the warm-up and now faces an anxious wait to see if he'll be involved in any of the final four league games. There's also, of course, the possibility that Southampton may have to go down the playoff route to the top flight. It has a knock-on effect because the Republic of Ireland play two friendly internationals in June against Hungary and Portugal. Now, ahead of the upcoming Investec Champions Cup semi-final at Croke Park between Leinster and Northampton.